Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. We call this the Dr. James Lynch Bariatric Surgery Show. This is because our special guest from St. Clair Regional Medical Center is a surgeon there, Dr. James Lynch. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
And also with us from the University of Kentucky, assistant professor with the Physician Assistant Program, Shelley Irving. Hi, Shelley.
Hello.
Thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio. Rick Phillips is on assignment in Isonville, and we'll be back next week. Remind you, if you want to learn more about Health Matters, if you want to listen to previous shows, if you want to skip over this show, or go back and figure out what we did wrong, that's WMKY.org. We've got all of our past shows there. You can download the MP3s, or you can just listen to them on your electronic devices. Point your friends that way. Send them the link. It in lieu of a real gift, it would be a fine thing to do. There's also many other fine shows, local programming from WMKY.org, from the radio station on that site. For our research, to communicate back with us, to look at our pages, we always put a link in with our show so that you can see some of the research we go over. That's HM Radio Show. That's on Facebook. Go there, talk to us, give us some feedback. We'll be glad to hear from you. Thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio. Our sponsor for this week's program, the Procedure of the Month Club. This month's procedure, bariatric surgery, taking the bulky out of Kentucky. You know, that is an absolutely terrible slogan. I don't think that's going to go, that's not going to push a lot of product.
There won't be any t-shirts with that on it.
Taking the bulky out of Kentucky. But we've got our top seven fun facts about bariatric surgery, and we'll give you a couple of them this time, and we'll go through the rest of them in our next fractional portion. First of all, fun fact number one. And you know, Shelley, I really wondered about this. The bariatric surgery part comes from the Greek word bar, which is weight. And you think about a barometer, which is the weight of the atmosphere. And, of course, iatric means treatment. So you're treating weight. And the iatric part is like pediatrics and geriatrics. So bariatrics is, in fact, treating weight. And that's how we got to bariatric surgery. Now, Jim, I've heard it called now metabolic surgery because we're changing a person's metabolism. Everybody knows it as weight loss surgery. How do you describe it to your patients?
You know, I still say bariatric surgery. I think it's the most familiar thing that people are used to. Weight loss surgery is something that I hear a lot of patients say. I do think of it as a metabolic operation, an operation that's going to help with your comorbidities, with your diabetes, with your knee pain and back pain. So I do see benefit to all of those, but in reality, it's whatever gets the patients through the door to see me and have a conversation about their weight.
Fundamentally, it is the weight loss that it produces does produce some significant metabolic changes. Fun fact number two, number of procedures performed in the U.S. has plateaued at around 200,000 per year. Fun fact number three, there are three general groups of surgeries. One is malabsorptive, and these are called the bypass procedures. They decrease the effectiveness of nutrient absorption from the gut. And what you do is, very simply, you could take a person's esophagus. I suppose, Jim, you could take their esophagus and hook it up to their rectum, and you could just basically everything you eat 30 seconds later comes out just like you ate it.
It's a great procedure for weight loss, but patients don't like it very much, and after a few weeks of absorbing no nutrients, they don't tend to do so well.
So what you do then is you move progressively up, and you can then bypass the part of your gut that absorbs certain nutrients. Now obviously there's problems there. You're going to have difficulty maintaining your vitamins and some of the nutrients that you need from the food. On the other hand, it's going to go around the absorption. It's going to come out the other end. That is malabsorptive or bypass procedures. And the other one is restrictive. And the purest form of the restrictive, if you want pure, is we call them banded gastroplasty or gastric bands, or the way people notice them. Stomach stapling used to be something done. And, of course, the procedure that I know you do mostly, the sleeve gastrectomies. And, again, this limits the solid food intake by making the stomach smaller. Now, there are – I want to stress to our radio fans, there are other effects, and we're just now understanding them, besides simply making a smaller stomach. They really do change the hormones in the gut, the hormones that are supposed to control your appetite. But we're learning about that as we go. We initially thought just a smaller stomach was all you got, and in fact, there's more in this. And then there are some mixed and other procedures. You can for instance, you can combine the bypass procedure with a restrictive procedure, and for that matter, you can also, we've talked about this on the show, you can put a balloon in your stomach. stomach and inflate it so that your stomach's always full with a balloon. Not recommended by those of us at Health Matters because of some problems with it. We are aware also there is you can make basically a pipe that drains your stomach. So you go and you eat, and then you just open a valve and drain all the food out. Not a very effective.
We call that one the human garbage disposal.
I just don't think, I mean, at some point you have to come to grips with what you're eating. Just simply being able to open a valve, I really don't like that procedure. But it is FDA approved. It is available now. And fun fact number four, we'll stop there. In terms of popularity, the lap banding procedure has dropped from 24% of all procedures in 2003 down to 9.5% in 2014. We can talk about reasons for that, but essentially you have to have more repeat operations and problems from that. Sleeve gastrectomy is, in 2016, the most commonly performed bariatric procedure in the world and in the United States. And then finally, there's something called a Roux-en-Y gastric bypass, one of the most commonly performed bariatric procedures, but it has declined some from two-thirds of all procedures in 2003 down to just under half in 2011. And that is our sponsor, Bariatric Surgery, the Procedure of the Month Club, taking the bulky out of Kentucky. You are not a native Kentuckian.
I am not, no. I'm actually a Texan by right. I was born in Louisiana, moved to Texas when I was 10 years old, and spent most of my life in Texas. Went to the University of Texas in Austin. An interesting road to medical school where I worked as a respiratory therapist for many years before I ever thought about going to medical school. And it was during that time I met a mentor, Jay Swishenberger. He's actually the chairman of surgery at the University of Kentucky. And he talked to me about going to medical school. And it hadn't crossed my mind. I had a bunch of kids and I didn't think it was very realistic. And it took somebody like him to really sit me down and say, you can do this and this is why you should do this. And he gave me 24 hours to make a list of pros and cons as to whether I should go to medical school or not. And when I came in the next day to have a meeting with him, and he said, okay, well, show me the list of pros, and it was pretty long, and the list of cons was pretty short. And he said, you know, there's your answer. And, so I started medical school when I was 32 years old. I finished medical school in Galveston when I was 36. Dr. Swishenberger had relocated from Galveston, where he was a heart surgeon, to Kentucky to take the chairman's job. And he was a mentor and a father figure to me. So I followed him to Kentucky. I did my 5 years of general surgery at the University of Kentucky, fell in love with the state, fell in love with the people, and more importantly, fell in love with a girl that lived in Moorhead. You know, I've been here for 2 years now. I love it. I want it to be my forever home.
Now, a couple of things then come about that. First of all, I think a lot of people who've been around doctors, especially if you've been around me much, most people think, well, I could do that. It's really not that. I mean, you have to have some knowledge of science, and you have to be able to read and take tests and things. But honestly, that's not the thing. I think, as you pointed out, the big thing is the sacrifice that you make in going through school, all that you're piling up that debt, and in working as a resident, which is not a particularly lucrative position. You make enough that you're not going further into debt, but that's about all you can say. So you had to really think about that, especially, I guess, with family and you already had a job, about going back.
It was tough. I mean, it is not an easy decision. You make a lot of sacrifices, but you know, you have to look at it not just the next year or the next 6 months, but the next 10 years, the next 20 years. I think so many people think that medical school is out of grasp for them when it's really not. I think with good mentorship, there is such a large percentage of the population that could go to medical school. And I think that's what most people are missing is that Jay Swishenberger in their life, that guy to say, you know, you can do this and here's why and here's how we're going to do it and here's a plan to do it. Because if you don't have somebody to hold you accountable, then it just becomes something that you talk about, but you don't ever really move forward on. And he was always there to hold me accountable towards moving towards medical school. And I think if I had to give one piece of advice to people thinking about it, is hold yourself accountable, set goals, look at those goals every semester and keep moving forward. You don't have to go when you're 22. You can go to medical school when you're 32 and be just fine.
But the key thing here, I think, is obviously even before then, as a respiratory therapist, you were thinking about healthcare. What drove you into healthcare? What are the things that made you want to choose this as a profession?
Well, you know, I guess it's probably not the best reason in the world. Or, you know, I have my first child when I was 18, and I needed a job that made pretty good money, that had good benefits. I had a cousin that was a respiratory therapist. I knew that I could work through the school, so I was able to keep a full-time job and go to college and able to start working in a hospital. And it wasn't until I really started working in a hospital that I understood that this was what I was going to do for the rest of my life. It really clicked for me. It was that first job, that first time of seeing a patient on a ventilator that I'm like, this is the job for me. I want to be in healthcare. I want to help people. I'm still just as passionate about getting to the hospital at age 43 as I was when I was 20 years old and a brand new respiratory therapist.
And you said you did go, you started medical school at
32.
At 32.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yep, 32 years old. I had three kids. My oldest two were in high school. My youngest child was in middle school. And, you know, the funny thing is, people talk about studying a lot. Now, I don't think people comprehend really how much you have to study when you're in medical school. I had a job while I went to medical school, and I ran an ECMO program, which is a kind of heart-lung bypass program in Galveston while I was in medical school. And so I did most of my studying on the weekends for medical school. And so I would bring my kids with me to school. We would get our own little classroom, and we would stay all day. I'd stay 8, 10, 12 hours on the weekends, Saturday and Sunday, to try to catch up through the week. And it was a sacrifice, but we spent time together. I'd always make time to go eat lunch with them. They would get bored and go shop on the Strand at Galveston, or, you know, terrorize my friends that were trying to study. But it was a shared sacrifice. And, you know, I think it was a good lesson for them. They learned that things aren't always easy and that you have to work hard to get to where you need to be. And I think they've both, or all three of them, have carried those lessons forward in life.
How did you get interested in obesity surgery?
Well, you know, I guess most of it is I've struggled with my weight my entire life. I don't think there's anybody who's ever struggled with their weight who hasn't heard, well, you need to just eat less, or why can't you lose weight, or if you just didn't eat so much, or maybe if you just exercise more. And I don't think the answers are that easy. And I think when you really study metabolic surgery and you look at the people that have had trouble with obesity their whole lives, you see that there's more to it, that it's not just a willpower, and it's not just a calories in versus calories out. There's more to it than that. And I think I've seen people that have struggled even more with their weight than I have at such an early age, and it imprisons you. I think when you look at people that have BMIs of 45 and 50 and they're in their 20s, they're losing a lot of their life to their weight. And anything I could do to change that, that it's a strong calling.
BMIs in the upper 40 would be, for the average height person, upper 200s, 300 or more pounds.
Yeah.
And I agree with you. From a health standpoint, it is very, very confining. We're going to come back with our second fractional portion and talk a little bit about bariatric surgery itself. Stay tuned for that. Take a break now, because we are going to, and come back with us. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio. This is the Dr. James Lynch Bariatric Surgery Show. I am your host, Dr. Tony Weaver. With me also from the University of Kentucky, Shelley Irving, assistant professor in the Physician Assistant Program. Hey, Shelley.
Hello.
And also our guest from St. Clair Regional Medical Center, general surgeon and weight loss surgeon, Dr. James Lynch. Hi, Jim.
It's great to be here.
For the second time, our sponsor, the Procedure of the Month Club, this month's procedure, bariatric surgery, taking the bulky out of Kentucky. And we remind you, we are going through our top seven fun facts about bariatric surgery. First of all, it comes from Greek words, bar meaning weight, barometer is the weight of the atmosphere, and iatric meaning treatment, so it is a weight treatment surgery. Fun fact number two, 2,000 procedures per year in the U.S., and that's been steady for the past several years. Fun fact number three, three general types of surgery, malabsorptive or bypass surgery. We bypass part of your nutrient-absorbing equipment so that no matter how much you eat, the food never sees the absorptive areas. The absorptive areas never see in the food. Obviously, that causes diarrhea. I mean, that's what happens when you don't absorb, is you pass this stuff. And so that's the problem with eating if you have that type of malabsorptive procedure. The other are restrictive, and this is stomach stapling, putting bands around the stomach, sleeve gastrectomies, and the gastric balloons. You make the size of the stomach smaller. Although, as we talked about, there's a lot more to it than simple volume. It does seem to alter the way your gut works when you do these things. And then there's a mixed type where you're doing things like putting in tubes to drain the stomach, putting in electrical stimulators for the stomach. You can also do a combination of a restricted procedure with some malabsorptive features. Fun fact number four, lap banding has dropped from 24% to 9.5% over the past about 15 years. One reason, because the weight loss is not quite as good and it needs a lot of revision. The sleeve gastrectomy is the most popular procedure in 2016. The gastric bypass procedure, still commonly performed, 47% of all procedures in 2011, but dropping slightly. Now we're up to fun fact number five. The bypass procedures lead to greater weight loss, but there is a greater risk. Problem with that greater weight loss is it occurs because you're not absorbing nutrients. You are no longer in control of your diet, and you can't simply eat more if you get sick, if you have chemotherapy or other things. The maximum weight loss usually in the first 10 months. And fun fact number six, and this we tend not to be too commercial, but we will tell you St. Clair offers the vertical sleeve gastrectomy for those people over age 18 with a BMI over 40 or a BMI greater than 35 and some type of obesity-related effect like diabetes or heart or lung problem. And then finally, fun fact number seven, three-year data suggests that the gastrectomy is comparable to the bypass procedures in terms of weight loss and in terms of diabetes remission, but as time goes on, the bypass procedures seem to be better. Now, again, being better at weight loss and at diabetes remission comes with increased risk, and we can talk about that some. That is our sponsor, Weight Loss Surgeries, Bariatric Surgery, taking the bulky out of Kentucky. Now, I want to start this just with a statement of the problem. Obesity in the United States in 2014, 28.9% self-reported. That's been stable, maybe because people have just stopped thinking of themselves as obese, maybe because we're doing something better. I don't know what we're doing better. It doesn't look like we're doing anything better. Prevalence higher in Midwest and South, lower in the Northeast and West. Dramatic increase in between 1990 and 2010, but stabilizing. And here's the thing. Obesity is associated with problems, with medical problems. Diabetes is number one. Diabetes and obesity go hand in hand. Obese people have higher rates of high blood pressure, higher rates of problems with their cholesterol, higher rates of heart disease, higher rates of stroke, higher rates of sleep apnea, which is a breathing problem. And let's be very clear about this, higher rates of cancer. Obesity is a risk factor for a number of cancers. So it's not simply, you can't say, well, you have your body image, I have my body image. We know that you, in fact, are at risk of a number of diseases. And I don't think that you can say, well, my body image is fine if your body image, in fact, increases your mortality. Healthcare expenditures, we all pay more for people who are overweight and obese. And weight loss generally is associated with a reduction in those types of morbidity and mortality. So that we know about obesity. Jim, let's walk me through this a little bit. When we talk about procedures for obesity, I mentioned the kind of patients, and I'll pull that back from our fun facts. People over age 18, although this surgery is done in children and adolescents.
You know, it is. It is. It's not done here. It's done at specialized centers. There was actually a study in New England Journal, I think last year, that looked at bariatric surgery in teenagers and preteens even, and it was very successful. But it needs to stay in specialized centers. I think to make the decision to operate on a child who doesn't have control of their diet, you know, still depends on their parents for food, is a tough one. And, you know, I think it's something best confined to large medical centers that have a lot of resources to take care of these kids.
Now, I noticed, at least in the advertising that St. Clair puts out, you do not say that the person has to fail weight loss drugs.
Correct.
I will tell you, I am not a fan of weight loss drugs. I reviewed them for purposes of this show, and once again, I was just kind of appalled. These drugs have high rates of side effects. The long-term outcomes with them are really not very good, and as I said, the side effects, the risk of these drugs are substantial. Shelley, you use the weight loss drugs ever?
No, I don't like them. I don't like their side effects. I think it can perpetuate an unhealthy lifestyle choice.
I have actually never prescribed them. I know there's the Ally, which is over-the-counter. That's Zenical prescription. It basically blocks your absorption of fats. And so when you eat food, you have something called greasy spotting. And so you check the underwear, and there's a greasy spot. because you can't control your bowels any. That's probably, ironically, the best, safest drug is one that makes you poop your pants and not have any control over it. That's the best you can do with weight loss drugs. Others can have everything from heart valve problems to increased rates of high blood pressure and stroke to changes in your mental status. Some of them are habit forming. The history of weight loss drugs is a very checkered one, and I note that you do not have that as one of your requirements, and I would wholeheartedly agree with that. I'm very disappointed in the medicines we have for weight loss. But getting back to this then, gentlemen, you got your person over age 18. Who are you looking for? Who's your ideal candidate?
I prefer somebody in their 20s. I think before any damage is done from them being as morbidly obese, that's certainly good. Somebody who tends to overeat as opposed to snack is very good for a sleeve gastrectomy. Somebody who has had that critical moment, so not that their mom told them to come see me or their husband told them to come see me, but they say, you know, I saw 300 pounds on the scale and it scared me to death. Or my doctor said, if I don't lose weight, I'm going to develop diabetes. They had that motivation to come and see me. So they're motivated, they have a high BMI, and they tend to overeat in a young person. To me, that is the perfect candidate. I know they're going to do well. I know they're going to lose weight. I know we're going to influence the rest of their life. And if I could have a clinic full of those people, that's all I'd do. But, you know, of course, that's not all you see. You know, and you see a lot of people who have been on weight loss drugs or weight loss programs for many, many years, and they end up with me as kind of a last resort. You know, I've tried every diet. I've tried every weight loss medication. I've lost some weight, but I always gain it back plus more. I can't seem to get a handle on my weight. And so really, it's while I have an idealized patient, it's really anybody who has a BMI above 35 with comorbidities or a BMI above 40 without comorbidities. And to me, I tell my patients that I think as doctors, sometimes we failed these patients because I always ask, has your doctor talked to you about your weight? And I am shocked a little and a little embarrassed at times that there's a lot of patients that I have that say, no, my doctor's never really said anything. I saw your advertisement on Facebook and thought I'd come in. To me, the when you have a BMI over 40, even if you don't have comorbidities, I think it's the equivalent of having a blood pressure of 200. But long term, we know that having a weight that high is going to hurt you. And as a physician, I think it is our obligation to talk to these patients about their weight. Now, I don't think you have to refer everybody for bariatric surgery, but you should talk to them just like you would talk to somebody who had a high blood pressure, that you have to do something. We have to do something to start to get the weight off. We have to start making changes or this is going to hurt your health. And I don't think that's a conversation that's easy to have. Patients are aware they're overweight, but they don't like to hear they're overweight. And I think sometimes as doctors, we tend to shy away from things that make patients uncomfortable. When I looked at our family practice at St. Clair, if you just look at patients that have BMIs above 30, so anybody who's considered to be obese, it was 40% of our practice. And when 40% of your patients have something that could potentially shorten their life, I think it's time to do something.
What's the impounds? What's the heaviest person that you've operated on? This is a community program.
Yeah, 440, I guess, was...
Now, we talked about the bypass procedures are, again, they're a little more effective but a little more risky. Is there an upper weight limit for the sleeve gastrectomy? You say, oh, you're really going to need a bypass to really be able to benefit?
I mean, yes. I think anybody can benefit from a sleeve. You know, if you look at there are bariatric surgeons who think that they can do the sleeve safer and quicker than in somebody who is super morbidly obese. So somebody who has a BMI over 75 or 80. And they will make that decision to do an operation on somebody even at that weight. Now, for my program, because we are in a community, we don't have a university hospital. This is in a community setting. I've set some limits on what I think is safe. And so patients that have significant heart history, I don't think are very safe to do out here. Patients that have a body mass index above 65, it's a discussion. And I don't think it's necessarily the right operation for them, especially if they have diabetes. So when you talk about patients with BMIs between 65 and above with poorly controlled diabetes, I think a Roux-en-Y gastric bypass is a better operation. Now, if you tell me I'm never going to have a bypass because my sister had one and she died or all her hair fell out, and I'll talk to you about the benefits and why I think it's safer. But ultimately, if you say I'm never going to have that procedure, I think offering you a sleeve gastrectomy is not the wrong thing to do. What I've offered to patients that have high BMIs like that is let's manage your weight. Let's see if we can't get you below 65. Let's see if we can't decompress your liver a little bit before we do this surgery. And I've actually had patients that went down from a BMI of 67 to a BMI that was a little more manageable, like 59, and have done their surgery and they've been successful.
What's the oldest patient you've operated on?
I did somebody who was 67. And it, again, I didn't sleep at night the night before I did that. I thought, well, you know, is this really the right thing to do? But she had a very convincing story that she was not heavy her entire life. She was in a car wreck, which was limiting her mobility. She gained 55 pounds within the span of a year, and her weight was just on an upward course. It was causing her major health problems in a very short amount of time. And, you know, we did a sleeve gastrectomy within the first 3 months. She was already off all her medications. She's lost the 50 pounds that she initially had picked up. She's slowly losing still, and she's very satisfied with it. But geriatric patients are it's a very special population because, number one, there's more risk. And number two, if you just look at how many years they have to prevent comorbidities, if you're talking somebody who's 70 years old, who's been obese all their life and already has problems from their diabetes and problems from all of their other comorbidities, then that's probably not the right operation for them. But I think in carefully selected patients that are older than 60, it's still a valid operation.
And then I guess the other question, I've got we have a partner on staff at St. Clair, and also I have a medical student. These people were not terribly overweight, but they looked ahead, and they mm-hmm. saw that yes. their future was most likely to be one of obesity and obesity-related disability. They decided to do it, I guess you would call it sort of prophylactically.
Yes.
What do you think about that?
You know, I think that's a little more controversial. I don't think it's the wrong thing to do. Again, when you're a surgeon, everything that you look at is judged by the risk of the surgery versus the benefit of the surgery. And in somebody who doesn't even have a BMI of 35, but has a family history where everybody in their family is obese and everybody in their family has diabetes, you can make a real argument that that person benefits from a sleeve more than the risk of doing a sleeve. I think that part of that is because the sleeve is so much safer now than it was even 15 years ago. It's so much safer than a Roux-en-Y gastric bypass that you can kind of make assumptions like that, that this risk is low, and even with modest benefits, this is still a beneficial procedure.
And I guess then I talk a little bit about insurance coverage. I assume that the selection criteria you use, age over 18, BMI over 40, BMI over 35 with associated diseases, that's a pretty standard thing the insurances will pay
pretty
for.
Pretty standard. Some insurances will want you to have a BMI over 40 with comorbidities. But most of what insurance wants you to do is they – you know, I always say, well, they don't want to pay for anything, but that's probably short-sighted. I say it half-jokingly, but in reality, they want to make sure that you pick the right patient at the right time. So most insurances will ask that your patient have a BMI over 35 with comorbidities, a BMI over 40 with no comorbidities. They'll ask for some period of medically managed weight loss. And what they want with that is they want them to meet with a dietitian so that you can start talking to them about losing weight, about changes they'll have to make as far as portion size and food selection. They will want them evaluated by a psychiatrist. And a lot of people think, does he think I'm crazy? Why is he having me go see a psychiatrist? And it's not really that. You know, even I was kind of, you know, I kind of wrote it off when I first started doing this, because they seem to, you know, it just seemed to be an obstacle in the road. But in reality, after meeting with the guys at St. Clair that do this for us, they offer a very good service. So many people eat for other reasons other than fuel. They eat because they're mad at their husband. They eat because they're sad that their mom died. They eat because they're stressed out. We're going to take that away from you. What are you going to do if you eat every time you get sad and now you can't eat like you did before this surgery? How are you going to cope with that? Are you going to turn to alcohol? Are you going to turn to drugs? And that's what they work with. And so I think it's an evaluation of their coping mechanisms, and I think it's a very beneficial part of the procedure now. Is so we have you meet with psych, we have you do your medically managed weight loss, we have you meet with our dietitian Jean Jones, who I've heard on the show before. She talks to you kind of about what life's like after, and if you're sickly and we need to get a pulmonologist to see you or a cardiologist to see you, we do that. But for the most part, this is patients that are relatively young and relatively healthy outside of their obesity. And so to me, it's kind of the same workup in my mind as if I was going to take your gallbladder out. It's a general anesthetic. It's a laparoscopic procedure. It takes about an hour. You stay in the hospital overnight.
Wow. Okay. That kind of gets me hit. Let me ask you, has anybody just come in and said, well, I'll just forget all that stuff. I'll just pay cash.
Yeah, they have actually. Yeah. And I try not to forget all that stuff. You know, there's no incentive. I believe in full disclosure. I know we always talk about it like it's something stupid, but I really do. And I tell patients, you know, I don't make one dime for doing 100 sleeve gastrectomies versus doing none. It's just not how I'm paid by the hospital. And so I want to be an advocate for you. I want to do this operation for you if it's safe for you. And I want to do everything I can to make sure that I'm not going to hurt you. And so if I think that you need to see psychiatry, I don't care if you're paying cash or not, I'm going to ask you to see psychiatry. And if I think you need a stress test or whatever, I'm going to get that because I don't want to do harm in this operation. That's my number one goal. Let's not hurt anybody.
So you get your patients are selected. Again, you said you bring them in. It's an overnight stay. Mm-hmm. It's a laparoscopic surgery. The scar being laparoscopic is?
There's usually four small incisions. One is about 15 millimeters. One is 11 millimeters. And the other two are 5 millimeters. So very, very, very small scars. But I always tell patients, just because the incisions on the outside are small doesn't mean that what we did on the inside was small. And so it's no different what we do on the inside than if we'd made a big incision. And so you can still have pain from that, from us having to dissect around and stapling off your stomach and mucking around on the inside there.
You know, we've got to – I don't think we have enough time to really to do this. I want to understand what the gastric sleeve, what goes on the inside. And I want to save that for our third and final fractional portion. We'll also talk about follow-up and a couple of other issues related to surgery. So we'll put that off for a minute while we do that. But at any rate, what we've talked about so far then, we are remind you, and this is key that you understand, there are a number of different procedures, and they really have different mechanisms of action. The one you're doing at St. Clair is the sleeve, the vertical sleeve gastrectomy, and this is what we call a restrictive procedure that limits the size of the stomach. There are other procedures. There are pros and cons to each one, and this is something that you should discuss with your healthcare provider. We're going to discuss having a break and come back with our third and final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the James Lynch Bariatric Surgery Show. With us from St. Clair Regional Medical Center is bariatric surgeon James Lynch. Hi, James.
Hello.
And also from the University of Kentucky, assistant professor with the Physician Assistant Program, Shelley Irving. Hi, Shelley.
Hello.
Our sponsor for the final time, the Procedure of the Month Club, this month's procedure, bariatric surgery, taking the bulky out of Kentucky. And I'll just remind you of our top seven fun facts about bariatric surgery. Fun fact number one comes from the Greek words bar, which means weight, and iatric, meaning treatment. It is a weight treatment surgery. Number two, procedures performed in the U.S. plateaued at around 200,000 operations per year. Fun fact number three, and this again, we've talked about it before, is critical. There are a number of procedures performed. Generally, they are malabsorptive or bypass procedures. These are procedures where the food is routed around the absorptive equipment, and this means that you are no longer in control of your ability to absorb things. On the other hand, no matter what you eat, it's going to come out the other end, and you're not going to be able to absorb enough to gain weight. And then the second type is restrictive, and that is the stomach stapling, the gastroplasties, and also gastric balloons that simply decrease the size of the stomach, but also appear to have some effect on hormones that we did not anticipate when we started doing this. And then finally, the third type, there's some mixed, everything from gastric stimulators to gastric emptying tubes. You can do the gastrectomies with a bypass addition as well. Fun fact number four, the lap band has dropped from 24% of all procedures to 9.5% in 2014. Gastrectomy now the most commonly performed weight loss surgery in the world and in the United States. Fun fact number five, the bypass procedures lead to greater weight loss and a more durable weight loss, but the risk is greater because you don't absorb key vitamins and nutrients. You have to be very careful with your diet, higher rates of complication. Fun fact number six, St. Clair offers the vertical sleeve gastrectomy. If you're over age 18, your body mass index is greater than 40 or greater than 35 with some additional health obesity-related health effects. And then fun fact number seven, the three-year data suggests that the sleeve gastrectomy is comparable to bypass procedures in terms of weight loss and diabetes remission, but at 5 years, at least one study shows that it is not quite as good as the Roux-en-Y, the bypass procedure, because of some weight regain and recurrence of diabetes. And again, what you would expect, because we restrict the size of the stomach, that can deteriorate over time, just like the size of everything else seems to change over time. But the bypass is one and forever. You will never again show food to that region of the of your digestive system. And that is our sponsor, Procedure of the Month, this month's procedure, bariatric surgery.
All right, Dr. Lynch, I've got a question for you.
Okay.
Prior to you coming, and our patients were having to go elsewhere in Kentucky to have these surgeries or procedures done, and we would kind of walk with them in primary care through those pre-surgery appointments, those weight loss things, those weight checks, and trying to help them develop these lifestyle changes that they will need to continue, you know, after the surgery. Every once in a while, I would have a patient say to me, if I lose any weight, then insurance won't pay for my surgery. How do you address it? How do you motivate the person but not make them lose that opportunity?
You know, that's tough. It's one of the toughest things we do is I feel like sometimes it's almost like you're hamstrung by the insurance companies. Now, I'll tell you that it's rare that you have somebody who has a BMI right on the threshold of 40. And if they lose even a modest amount of weight, that they're going to lose this, like you said, they're going to lose this opportunity from their insurance company. I'll tell you as a surgeon that there is very little evidence that what you lose preoperatively is predictive of what you're going to lose postoperatively. I try not to worry too much about what preoperative weight loss you have. I'm more concerned about, you met with my dietitian, are you making the food choices we asked you to make? Are you picking healthier proteins? Are you cutting down on your portion size? Have you stopped drinking carbonated beverages? If you're a smoker, have you quit smoking? Those are the things to me that matter, that affect kind of how you're going to do postoperatively. And so I try not to get too far into are you losing 5 pounds a month or 7 pounds a month or 10 pounds a month? Because I really don't think it matters. And so for my patients that are right on the borderline, I tell them, let's work on healthy food choices. Let's get you moving. I like for you to exercise 10 to 15 minutes a day, 6 to 7 days a week. And if you lose weight, then that's a good thing. We need to lose weight. But most of the time you'll see that the weight loss will be very modest and we'll still be able to do the surgery.
Jim, you mentioned that, it is a laparoscopic surgery. You spend your overnight in the hospital and then you're back home. What exactly do you do on the inside that restricts the size of the stomach?
Well, what we do is if you look at a normal stomach, it can hold about 2 liters of fluid. So if you think about a 2-liter pop bottle, that's about how much a normal stomach can hold. As we eat and that stomach gets full, it sends a signal to our brain that we're full called the satiety signal. What we do is we go in and we remove about 90% of the stomach. There is no sleeve involved. Everybody's like, well, when are you going to put in the sleeve? There is no sleeve. We turn the stomach into something that looks like, if you think about a long sleeve shirt, it looks like the shirt sleeve. I think it would be better if we called it a banana stomach because it kind of looks like a banana when we're done. And that banana can hold about 200 mLs or about 10% of that original volume that your stomach held before. Now, that limits how many calories you can get in any certain amount of time. But also, it resets that satiety signal, right? So you eat just a small amount of food, and you get the signal to your brain that you're full. And so I think one of the keys to this surgery that, like you said, we didn't anticipate, is that people just aren't very hungry after they have this surgery. They have this surgery, they eat a small amount of food, and we have a lot of patients that are like, you know, I almost got to set a thing on my iPhone to remind me to eat, because otherwise I just don't get hungry. But what we do is we go in there and we use a surgical stapler. We identify the proper portion of the stomach away from the pylorus, or the part that leads to the small intestine. And we use this surgical stapler to actually divide and staple the stomach from the very bottom of the stomach all the way to the top at, near the GE junction. We also use an electronic scalpel, if you will, to take down the attachments between the stomach and the spleen, called the short gastric vessels. Once the stomach's completely free, the stomach that we're going to remove is completely free, we pull it out right through your abdominal wall. It's kind of like pulling a rabbit out of a hat. It's a really tight fit. One of the big concerns when you do this procedure is that you can have a staple line leak, which is where we staple the stomach off. Those staples can separate. The technology is a lot better now. The staplers are a lot better now. Our leak rate is very, very low now. Maybe one out of every 100 cases will develop a leak that's usually pretty easily treated with something that doesn't involve a whole another operation.
At the end of the surgery, your stomach looks like a tube.
That's right.
So you got this stomach that looks like a tube. You've pulled out the rest of it, which means then that this is you can stretch that out, but this is not reversible. You can't go and stick it back in.
No, I throw that portion of your stomach away, so you can't have it. You can stretch it out, and that's one of the things that can lead to weight regain.
So to make sure that we've got to hammer this, I think this is really important. This gives you a chance, and certainly when you come out of the operating room, you can't eat large meals. You
Correct.
Simply can't, because it will make you ill. On the other hand, over time, if you keep pushing this, eventually you can stretch things out, and it will basically cancel the effect of the surgery. Now, what about the complications? What do we worry about with this surgery?
My biggest worry is always that you could develop a leak along the staple line. It's rare. We haven't really had one at St. Clair, but it happens. Most of these do not require a reoperation, but it could be a devastating complication. It's the one thing that I fear the most with this operation. Everything else is pretty standard football as far as, you know, you could have some bleeding, but it's very rare. You could have a port site infection, but that's usually very easily managed with just a little local procedure in the office. Hernia formation happens after almost all surgery that we could do. You're always at risk for hernias. But this is a pretty good prep for not getting a hernia, because I always tell people the two things that I think cause hernias the most are gaining weight and smoking. And this operation makes you lose weight, and I won't do it if you smoke. So hernia formations is actually pretty rare.
Now, you have, of course, complete control of your absorption. So this is not, you don't have to eat, you want to keep your portion size small. Is there a special diet other than a sensible diet that you follow?
Yeah, there is. Jean Jones, our dietitian, she's very good at working with our patients as far as making a lifetime of changes. But the main thing that we talk about is that we need you to get, you have a little bitty stomach now. You don't have room for donuts, and you don't have room for, popcorn and all this junk food. Everything you put in your mouth has to be for fuel and to make your body work better. And so it's a very protein-heavy diet. We tell patients that they have to eat their protein first. You don't drink with your meals, and you end up eating very slowly, chewing your food very thoroughly, not drinking with your meals, and then sipping on water or unsweetened tea all day to keep yourself hydrated. So it is a very protein-heavy diet, but we stress the low-fat, leaner sources of protein like chicken and fish.
What about vitamins?
You know, I love vitamins. I do tell my patients they need to take vitamins. The main thing is because it's hard to get enough variety from fresh vegetables with this the limited volumes of food that you're eating. So a good bariatric formulated vitamin is always recommended for the rest of your life. One of the special things that I think we do specifically that I don't hear a lot of other patients that have had procedures other places talk about is one of the things that the only vitamin that or the only mineral that I think you would have trouble with after this surgery is absorption of iron, because you release intrinsic factor in your portion of the stomach that we remove, and that helps you with iron absorption. So we tell our patients, you know, get a vitamin that's formulated for bariatric surgery that has iron in it, but also not to take calcium with your iron, to take the calcium separately. And so we have them take a bariatric vitamin, then calcium chews 30 minutes after that, because calcium and iron kind of compete for the same binding sites is what I've been told.
Now, after the procedure's done, what kind of follow-up? I mean, the wound heals. You got to check the wound healing. Yeah. Is there long-term follow-up on this procedure?
There is, and I always say this is kind of like getting married to your surgeon because I'm going to see you forever. I think there's an accountability reason for that. I want to see you. I want to look you in the face, and I want to talk about your weight loss for the rest of your life. And so I'm going to see you. If we do this operation on Tuesday, you'll go home from the hospital on Wednesday. I see you in my office on Friday. I see you at 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, and then every year until one of us dies. Hopefully me and not you.
Well, we'll flip a coin on that one, I guess. Then a couple of things I just wanted to talk about. This is hot off the press. This was from Obesity Surgery, February 16th. The partner's experiences, and they mentioned there were three interconnected processes of change. One is that the partners are engaged in the surgical process with their spouses, and they find that after surgery, obviously the dietary habits, everything changes with their spouses, and they have to make that adjustment. What have you seen in the families of your surgical patients?
You know, it's funny. Almost every patient that I that comes to me is like, well, you either operated on a friend or a family member, or I know somebody who you've operated on, or I know somebody who's had this procedure and been very successful. I mean, you could go with the everybody loves a winner theory that, you know, you see somebody who's done very well and how it's very empowering once you've lost a lot of the excess body weight to, you know, get back to life, to be more active and to do all these things that you weren't doing for all these years. And I think if you're married to somebody who you see them getting their life back, you want your life back too. And it is, you see spouses and brothers and sisters and, you know, aunts and uncles and you name it. They usually, if you get one family member who's successful, you end up with at least a couple more from that same family.
I have to say it would be kind of difficult to adopt a post-gastrectomy diet if you had not had the gastrectomy.
I tell patients that. They ask me, you know, do I have to have this surgery? I'm like, no, I can have Gene come in here. We could tell you exactly how to eat just like you had a sleeve gastrectomy, but you're going to be pretty hungry. And hunger is a very powerful motivator. And I think that's the reason we're successful with a sleeve gastrectomy where you couldn't be without one is because you don't have that hunger. It's that satiety signal is so powerful.
I'd like to thank our guest, Dr. Jim Lynch, who is the bariatric surgeon at St. Clair Regional Medical Center. And Shelley, can you get us off the air?
I sure can. Special thanks to our Morehead State Public Radio producer, Brian Courtney, and Eric Bilbrey, who wrote our Health Matters theme song. And to you, our loyal radio fans, remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to our show, go to WMKY.org or just visit us on Facebook at HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show. And remember, Health Matters shares these side effects with the weight loss drug, Qsymia.
Health Matters is the only FDA-approved once-daily prescription weight loss radio show that contains two co-hosts that can help you lose weight and keep it off.
Health Matters' unique patented formulation can help you eat less by reducing your appetite and help you feel more satisfied with what you've eaten. The precise mechanism of action of the two co-hosts on chronic weight management is unknown.
Do not listen to Health Matters if you're pregnant, planning to become pregnant, or become pregnant during our show, have glaucoma, have thyroid problems, are taking medicines called monoamine oxidase inhibitors, or have taken these medications in the past 14 days. See the Health Matters page 1, the WMKY program guide, for a complete list of ingredients in Health Matters.
Health Matters can cause serious side effects, including
birth defects. If you listen to our show during pregnancy, your baby has a higher risk for birth defects. These defects can begin early in pregnancy, even before you know you are pregnant. Women who are pregnant must not listen to Health Matters. Women who can become pregnant should have a negative pregnancy test before listening and every month while our show is on the air.
If you become pregnant during our show, stop listening immediately and tell your healthcare provider right away.
Health Matters can increase your heart rate at rest. Your healthcare provider should check your heart rate while you listen to our show. Tell your healthcare provider if you experience a racing or pounding feeling in your chest when our show is on the air.
Suicidal thoughts or actions. One of our co-hosts may cause you to have suicidal thoughts or actions. We're not naming names. Call your healthcare provider right away if you have any of these symptoms, especially if they are new, worse, or worry you, or if you have any other unusual changes in behavior or mood.
Serious eye problems, which include any sudden decrease in vision with or without eye pain and redness or a blockage of fluid in the eye causing increased pressure in the eye. These problems can lead to permanent vision loss if not treated.
Central nervous system side effects. The use of prescription sleep aids, anxiety medicines, or drinking alcohol with Health Matters may cause an increase in symptoms such as dizziness and lightheadedness. Do not drink alcohol with health matters.
Possible seizures if you stop listening too fast. Seizures may happen in people who may or may not have had seizures in the past if you stop listening to our show too fast. Your healthcare provider will tell you how to stop listening to Health Matters slowly.
Whatever you do, do not take Health Matters lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week for more exciting news from the world of medical research on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.